It's the weekend, and you have financial questions that need answering. That can only mean one thing. It's time for Jill on Money, the show that takes the mystery out of your finances. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to Jill on Money. We are delighted that you are joining us today. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. You know, I just put some lotion on my hands. It's a little too greasy. Getting it all over the place here in the studio. Sorry, Mark. Not his problem. He never comes into this side of the studio anyway. All right, it's May. It's exciting. It's finally spring. April's like a tease month, at least here in the Northeast. You know, one day it feels like it's 80 and the next day it's 20, it feels like. Well, it's not 20. It's a little exaggeration. Anyway, this show is really dedicated to you guys out there who have financial questions. Maybe they are investments. Maybe they're estate questions. Maybe it's a tax question. Once you've filed your returns, a number of tax issues often pop up. I'd love to hear from you. And there are a lot of ways to get in touch with us. 855-411-JILL. That's our phone number. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. Askjill@jillonmoney.com. Very easy. Follow us on Twitter at Jill on Money. Mark's been like kicking up the Twitter account like crazy. So there's some great stuff you've been tweeting. He tweets under my handle and I tweet under my handle. Have you stopped tweeting under your own handle, essentially? Yeah, you and I are becoming fused. We are as one. We are work spouses. We are sharing an account, essentially. That's right. And so if you want more of Mark and Jill and the show, you can go to our website, jillonmoney.com. You can listen to past shows. Or if you miss any part of this show, don't freak out, because you can always wait after the weekend. Shows go up on the website, jillonmoney.com. Click on the radio tab and you will be able to find us. All right, let's go take a call. We like to start the show that way. It's Sandy in California. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to Jill on Money. What can I do for you?
Hi. I had some questions about long-term care coverage or plan that I bought. The California Public Employees Retirement System, CalPERS, years ago initiated a long-term care plan. It seemed like a good idea to get that, and I didn't wait until my 50s or 60s. I signed up early, trying to keep the premiums low.
Great.
Well, as things happened, the plan got into financial trouble, and they raised premiums many times.
Mm.
So at this point, my premiums are not that high, but in exchange for not taking all the premium increases, I gave up some benefits. Still in all, now that I'm retired, I'm paying all my health insurance and employer share zero. Mm. And it looks like I might get enough expenditures to itemize my deductions for medical and actually take some. Long-term care premiums are supposed to be deductible, but only for qualified plans. I don't know if this CalPERS coverage or program is a qualified long-term care type of insurance. They say it's not insurance, it's a plan. Do you happen to have any information about that?
That is very interesting. So just so I understand this, you pay the premium on the long-term care insurance. Right, let's just call it long-term care because it's not insurance yet, but let's just say you pay the premium, right?
Yes.
Okay. And on the long-term care program. And it is not at all, they are not putting any money towards it. It's out of your pocket. What's the amount of the premium?
About $85 a month, and it probably will adjust year by year.
Okay.
Because I have inflation protection, which they're going to start charging us for now.
Okay. And if you looked at, and how old are you, Sandy?
59.
59 or 69?
59.
Okay. So here's the, forgetting about the long-term care program versus insurance question for a moment. In order to deduct your unreimbursed medical expenses, which would include, you know, the premiums on this long-term care, it would have to be more than 10% of your adjusted gross income. So what is your income currently?
It varies. My basic income is about $60,000 per year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can take variable withdrawals from some of my retirement savings plans, some of which would be taxable. I have to also combine this with out-of-pocket medical and the premiums for health insurance.
Correct.
Altogether, in the next few years at least, I might be within range of being able to take this deduction, but I just don't know if this one particular product
is really deductible. So my guess is that it is, but what I would do is you work with an accountant?
Yes.
Okay. What I would do is I might just kind of jingle the accountant just to make sure. But I'm going to say that, you know, if qualified, I think would really, it would be hard not to, I popped onto the CalPERS long-term care participant website, and I see what you mean. It says CalPERS long-term care program. I wonder if there is a specific definition of qualified. I bet that CalPERS fits in it, but I would ask your accountant for that. And what you may want to do is just shoot an email to the CalPERS folks and just say, is this considered a qualified plan under IRS rules? And that's what I would do. And I think that it's good to know before you start, you know, trying to claim. I wouldn't claim it without knowing the answer to it. I guess that's what I would say. And give it a shot, because I think it's hard. It would be hard to say it's not, but it really, because it acts like an insurance plan. It sort of smells like an insurance plan. You're paying the premiums and presuming that all those unreimbursed expenses are more than 10% of your AGI. Maybe it's not this year, but, you know, in certain years, then yeah, I'd be delighted if you could do that. That would be a great thing for you. But I would find out one more piece of information. I'm guessing it's a yes.
Okay, there's a part B to this question.
Do it.
If I do deduct premiums at some point in the future, are the benefits that I someday receive when I get old going to be tax-free,
no,
or does that make,
no,
it taxable?
Does not make it, does not have an impact on that. I think what you're confusing, and it is confusing, sometimes when you have a benefit that's paid by the employer, like if CalPERS was saying, we're paying for your long-term care insurance or we're paying for your disability insurance, when you actually need the benefits, then if your employer paid for it, then it's taxable. But no, you taking the deduction for it is not, it does not change the taxability of your benefit. So that's good news. All right, Sandy from California weighing in on long-term care. And you, by the way, you notice that she said there have been premium increases. That's more and more the case with these long-term care policies. If you've got an old long-term care insurance policy kicking around, you've got a question about it, or you're receiving a notice that your premiums are rising and you want to understand what your options are, why don't you give us a call? 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back.
Question, call anytime 24/7 855-411-JILL. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. She's a pillar by the day,
a fire by You're back with Jill on Money. And if you've got a financial question, we would love to hear from you. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. And our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. And it can be about anything. I always feel like as people start to look forward to the summer, they really don't want to deal with their money stuff. So hurry up before the summer hits. Send us your questions. We'd love to get you on the air live, or just send us an email and I'll read it. It's okay. It's more fun when you do it on your own voice. More exciting things occur. That's what I'm hoping is going to happen with Jim from Atlanta. Hi, Jim. Welcome to Jill on Money. How are you?
I'm great, Jill. Yourself?
Fantastic. What can I do for you, sir?
Well, I've listened to your program in the evening. It's on a radio station here in Atlanta in the evening, and I was listening last time, and you talked about withdrawal rates, mm-hmm. and saying that they're from 2.5 to 4, and you picked a 3, and I got to thinking, well, is that based upon maintaining the principal rather than consuming it? Because I could see in my personal situation, I'm 72, my wife's 75. Let's say we both programmed to live till 95. Well, if I took my estate and drew it to 0 at 95, it seemed I could withdraw at a greater rate than 3%.
Yes, you are asking a perfectly reasonable question, which is, what is the presumption under the withdrawal rate? And it is the presumption, not so much that you'll go that you'll maintain it exactly, but that you won't run out of money. And the likelihood of you running out of money obviously changes based on how much money you're withdrawing. And so financial planners and the folks who do kind of the analytical data behind some of these concepts try to figure out what the success rate is. So they say, well, look, if we have people withdrawing about 4% a year, chances are they're not going to run out of money based on their life expectancy and how much they are spending, right? And mm-hmm. the thing that's kind of interesting in your case is you're right. If we say, okay, now that you're 72 and 75, there's, you know, obviously finite time. And yeah, you could beat the odds. You could live an extra 10 years. But could you actually take a higher withdrawal rate? Could you do that? And how much money, what's the total amount that's in the nest egg, let's call it?
Well, and that's another sort of variable. I got, let's say, $1.5 million in cash or securities, mm-hmm. and probably another over $1 million in real estate.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, I would feel that as I downsized and possibly went to a assisted living home or something like that, I'd be converting those assets to liquid assets.
Yes.
They wouldn't be part of my withdrawal rate now, but once they were liquidated.
You could.
I could.
Absolutely.
And I have a second-die life insurance policy that's designated for my children, so I didn't see the need to preserve the corpus.
Right. I get what you're saying. How much are you withdrawing now, in general?
In general, I'm probably pulling out, I haven't done a percentage, gracious. Let me do a quick percentage. Too many zeros.
I hate when that happens. Although I like when there's too many zeros when you're getting a check, when you receive a check. Just not the writing of them. Those are not as much fun. I hear a sound that I haven't heard.
Yeah,
in a long time.
I guess just last year I took out about 6%.
Okay, and so I think that what you're saying is, let's say that you took 6% out. Let's just say you did that for the next 10 years. Obviously, your cash and securities account would drop down in value, right? Because mm-hmm. you know you're pulling this money out, and you know, obviously, if there's like a bear market in between, then that becomes, you know, even more of a critical issue. But the question I have for you is, how easily could you convert the $1 million in real estate? In other words, you're living in one of the, do you have one property worth $1 million, or do you have a number of properties worth $1 million?
I have two. Well, I have three, I guess. My daughter's living in one of them, so.
Can't kick her out.
So I'm not going to kick her out, so that would stay. The other two, one of them would be very readily, the lesser of the two would be marketable, probably could be sold in the Atlanta market within a month or two.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is a mountain home that would be more difficult to sell. So, and it's the more expensive of the two.
So here's what I would say to you is if your thesis is, look, right now in the next few years, while I still have this real estate, I'm pulling more money out of my portfolio. Is that okay? The answer to that question really is it depends on how fast you can convert an illiquid asset to a liquid one. And so my rule of thumb withdrawal rate would really be you should, you know, maybe I would be pulling back on instead of doing 6% out of that amount of money, I might pull that back a little bit and try to do 5%. I'd be looking at really when is the right time to sell those properties. Here's the downside of your game plan right now, Jim, okay? If this were 2006 and you and I were talking, I would say you're pulling too much money out of your portfolio. And you'd say, but it's growing and everything's fine. And then 2007 comes and 2008 comes. And then your cash securities account goes down in value. Your real estate goes down in value. And all of a sudden, your whole beautiful game plan at age 80 is falling apart. So I think that if you were really needing, you know, 80, 90 or 100 grand a year to pull from your total assets, that I would prefer to start making some of that real estate liquid today rather than wait in the future. So that's my only cautionary tale, that you never know.
Do I think
80% of the time, do I think you'll be okay? Sure. But the 20% is a big enough risk that it makes me worry.
Right. No, great counsel. As I say, when I was hearing your rates, I thought nobody's mentioning whether that's a preservation of principal or that's consuming principles.
So yeah, it is a little bit of both, and I thank you for calling to clarify that. So it's very helpful. All right, my friend, good luck to you. Go sell some real estate and call us back and let us know how it's going on, okay?
All right. Thank you, Jill.
Take care. That is just a very interesting question. That's a good one, right, Mark? You like that? I like that one. This is a thoughtful question. It's really a thoughtful question. And it's one that, you know, again, when everything is going well, is the perfect time to ask these questions. The wrong time to ask that question is when you're 79 and your $1.5 million is worth 1.1 and your real estate that you thought was $1 million is worth $600,000 or $700,000. It's one of the reasons, actually, that I find it very worrying to count on real estate in retirement. And it used to be that I would have to convince people of that. But now we have actually a real estate boom and bust that proves that. That if you're hoping that your real estate will bail you out of any issue that arises later in life, you better have a lot of real estate and a lot of other liquidity. I don't want anyone to get caught at the wrong time with the wrong strategy. Your better strategy is to be a bit more conservative today, pull a little bit less money out of your portfolio, and start to get your game plan for how you're going to unload some of your illiquid real estate. All right? You are listening to Jill on Money. Money is not scary and it's not boring. It's a little bit of fun here. Give us a holler at 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It's Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Have a question? Call or email anytime. 855-411-JILL or ask Jill at jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I'm Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planning board of standards senior ambassador. Senora, ambassadora. I like that. Senora ambassadora. Has a nice lilt to it. That should be my official title now. All right. We love to hear from you. So especially if you're going to write an email, give us lots of info. Before tax season was like in the heat of everything, I had written an article about ways to reduce your tax bill. And I got a couple of questions here about I wanted to reiterate, although most people, you've already filed your taxes unless you're on extension. But the question comes around deductibility of unreimbursed medical expenses, which is kind of a pain in the neck because it used to be pretty easy to deduct your unreimbursed medical expenses. Now, if you are under the age of 65, to have any of those, in order to take that deduction, the total expenses, including the premiums for your long-term care insurance, Janet wrote in about that, those expenses have to be more than 10% of your adjusted gross income. If you're over the age of 65, then it drops down to 7.5%. But hey, that could be a lot of money, right? Just depends on your situation. But for example, in Janet's case, she's 70, and she said that her long-term care insurance premium, $3,245, which was not more than 7.5% of her income. So you couldn't do it. It's a bummer. And I'm sorry to say that because it's, those are real expenses, but you know, I'm going to be very interested to hear as to whether people are really going to react to any tax reform that starts changing the nature of these deductions, because it's sort of like a pain in the neck to think about it, right? Why do I have to deal with all these deductions? It's such a pain in the neck. But then you're like, oh, but I like my deductions. So that's the problem with tax reform. It's so difficult because every single part of the tax code has a very clear winner and loser. So you say, oh, yeah, I just want a lower rate, except you find out that, you know, if the rate is lower, your tax bill may not go down as much because those deductions were worth a lot to you. But we'll have to see. A listener from Colorado writes that she's just turning 79, and she says, and now is a great time to reflect on how we came to be comfortably retired, although neither I nor my husband ever had large salaries. After reading your column in the Denver Post, I wanted to tell you a story which started when at age 45, I found myself a single parent with a very bright son in high school. My assets included a small house with a small mortgage, a used car, and a job teaching, which paid about $29,000 a year. In addition, I paid $25 a month into a tax-sheltered annuity. So as you suggested, I figured out what I could do about it, started studying for my master's degree, researching strategies for college financing and admissions. To make a long story short, I granted my master's and a salary raise to $42,000 the month before my son began his studies at an out-of-state private college for the same price as in-state tuition at the state university. Hard work. Probably the hardest I've ever done, but worth every minute. He graduated owing, wait for it, $1,100 in student loans. A year after my son entered college, I married my husband, this pastor of a small church who didn't make much more money than half my salary. To both of us, money is only a means to an end, not an end in itself. We got my son and his through college. Then we began putting every spare cent into investments with a financial advisor that we still use today. We lived frugally until he retired at 65, began to draw Social Security and his church retirement. 4 years later, we had the opportunity to teach and work as volunteers in Southeast Asia. I love these people's lives. I was offered early retirement package that included a $5,000 payout and health insurance until I reached age 65. I took it and off we went. The money went into investments. We had a life-changing experience, again, worth every minute of our time. In the early 90s, when the stock market seemed to be rising too fast, I asked our financial advisor to move us to more conservative investments. After the crash, while other retirement accounts dropped, we stayed pretty steady. We spent the next 20 years fulfilling our dreams of travel, visiting 75 different countries. Budget travelers, we always found bargains, usually staying in cheap hotels, but enjoying every minute. 3 years ago, we decided that we should move somewhere close to family, chose a place 20 minutes from my son. Using the profit from the sale of our paid-off home, we bought half a duplex in a lovely and friendly 55-plus community with all the amenities. We have a $119,000 mortgage. The house has increased in value Since we bought it, we live comfortably on our pension, Social Security. It's about $57,000 a year, another $7,000 in distributions from our retirement accounts. Good medical coverage through his church. Mine is a Medicare Advantage plan. Neither of us pays extra into our plans other than what is deducted from Social Security. $300,000 in savings and investment. Inflation and my husband's mobility have limited our travel to a long cruise each year, shorter trips to visit our other children. We have good health and work through healthy diet, So as you write, it is possible to have a comfortable retirement, even if you don't earn much money. Just set your goals and work toward them. Then enjoy the fruits of your labors. You don't have to keep your nose to the grindstone all the time. It helps that we have set retirement money coming in each month. We are enjoying life at ages 79 and 90. That's so great. What's great about this story is that it does show you that these paths are possible. And it does also indicate, you know, sometimes people write in and they say you only have rich people who are talking about what this is. Not a rich person. This is by all means and a middle class American couple that has figured it out. So, unnamed writer, thank you so much for writing in, because you are really a beacon for all those who are listening. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill@jillonmoney.com.
That's life. That's what all the people say.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. All right. Here is a nice note here from Steve, who said that he read a article that I wrote about retirement money stress. And he says, I am 56 years old, a small business owner. By small, I mean four employees and less than $500,000 in revenue. I find it hard to believe 75% of employees have access to employer-based retirement plans, even if they do. Now, let me tell you that again. He's lost a punctuation there, so that's true. I find it hard to believe that 75% of employees have access to employer-based retirement plans. Even if they do, they don't make enough to contribute. Even 1% takes away from basic needs today. This is a fallacy promulgated by those with more than enough, especially the industry that stands to benefit the most, financial services. I choose to offer myself and my employees the best route to forever happiness. Plan on working forever. After all, we as humans are best suited to being productive every day. To be engaged on an intellectual and physical level sustains our physical and mental health. I have the best example in my own family. My mother and siblings all had dementia, except my mom's twin brother, who has yet to stop working. I mean, just put a jinx on the to that guy, right? I, for one, plan on following in his footsteps. Feel free to continue this discussion. Steve, I have a lot of thoughts about this. I agree. I think it's fantastic to work as long as you can. But that presumes that you can. You know, when you say to me, when you say that contributing 1% takes away from basic needs today. A very interesting thing about a lot of retirement surveys is that they often will have a question that they sneak in towards the middle to the end of the survey. When people say, I'm so broke, I can't, I live paycheck to paycheck. That's the reason I don't contribute. And then they sneak a question in that goes something like, if you could, do you think you could spare $10 a week to save? And vast majority of people, even when they are the working poor, say, yes, I could. right? So yeah, you're right. Paycheck to paycheck, it stinks. And I'm not saying that that's, you know, the best case scenario, but all I'm suggesting is that if someone said, I could not spend $5 a week on something and try to save it, and most people say they could do that, and that's pretty interesting. Now, I think that a different fallacy is that people can say they can blow off making hard decisions today and instead say, I will work forever. And I don't buy it. First of all, there's a lot of people who do physical work and they cannot do it forever. That's clear. The second part is, who knows? You work for yourself. That's wonderful. But what if you work for a place where they don't want you? What if you get downsized? What are your options then? So I agree. I want to work as long as I possibly can. I don't want to say, I don't want to wake up at 4 o'clock a.m. to do that. Duly noted, Mark. Don't need to be waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning. But that said, I think that working as long as you possibly can is wonderful, but it's not always possible. And that's the part of this that continues to really keep me up at night. I just don't think that it's reasonable to say, I'm going to work forever, and then sort of take yourself off the hook for doing some of the stuff you need to do. That's kind of where I am on that. It's thorny. And I don't want it to be all judgy. Like, I'm not saying, oh, you're a bad person if you cannot save that 1%. Some people really cannot save the money. But the other hand, I think that sometimes we are placing this bet of like, oh, I guess I'll just work forever and that will be okay. That feels like I'm giving away my power. So I don't love that. I really don't. All right, what's my time here, man? Less than 2 minutes. My God. Mark, should college students be required to take a personal finance course? But you want it to be in high school? This is an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal from a ways back. I was looking at this about finance and educating yourselves. And, you know, this woman is a professor of law in Los Angeles. And one of the things that she points out is, and I think that we've heard this from my friend Helene Olin, who wrote Pound Foolish, the scathing analysis of personal finance industry. There is scant evidence that personal finance courses lead to better financial decisions. That is so depressing to me. What are we doing this show for? All right. I need to back up from that. I think let's just consider this. You're not going to be a super genius just by taking a personal finance course, but you might feel like you have a little bit more control and you know the right questions to ask. And so I am going to say that no matter what, I always think educating yourself is a little bit better. Just because I took driver's ed doesn't mean I'm going to become a good driver, but I'm still going to take it. And I'd rather know something than nothing. Anyway, this is Jill on Money. And when we come back, more of your questions. I'm going to dig deeper into this. 855-411-JILL. Ask Jill at JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back. But my heart just ain't gonna buy it. And if I didn't think it was worth one single try. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, give us a holler. Our number here, 855-411-JILL. You can send us an email, askjill at jillonmoney.com. Okay, now here's something just kind of dovetailing on that conversation about whether you should have personal finance courses or not. I just pulled this up with a little research that says basic financial literacy, okay? The U.S. ranks 14th internationally with a passing percentage rate of a whopping 57%. Come on, we got to do a little bit better than that. Five states require high school students to take a standalone personal finance course. 12 states require personal finance instruction that can be integrated into another course. I mean, by the way, why math teachers wouldn't just use the example of personal finances is beyond me. That's the easiest thing in the world to do, right? 20 states require high school students to take a course in economics. Why take a course in economics before you can even do a course in personal finance? That's one question. Fewer than 20% of teachers say they feel competent to teach personal finance topics. All right. I want to say that we should do personal finance in high school. And I think they have to be well-constructed personal finance classes, that they should be taught by the teachers, probably part of math curriculum. And, you know, why is that such a big... You can literally use this probably in middle school as well. Because, that, by the way, you're not allowed to say junior high school anymore. Shh, don't tell anybody. You know, I certainly believe that you're better off having some information than no information. And the more you have, I know it doesn't mean you're going to lead to better outcomes, but at least you've got a shot. With no education, you're really flying blind. And without a net, if I can mix my metaphors. Okay, stay tuned. We're going to queue up the interview. It's going to be very fun. Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.